The Sin and Snob podcast is brought to you by Alamo Drafthouse. Cody, you wanted to talk about our next screening coming up at the Drafthouse. What is it?
So it is a screening of End of Watch, which is a movie from, I think, 2011 with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena. It's a cop movie that is shot handheld style, kind of like found footage in a way. Really one of the first examples, other than maybe Cloverfield, of the found footage thing truly working to its full potential. I don't know how well you remember that movie, but it's crazy intense and awesome and funny.
I don't remember it that well. I do remember, though, that it is David Ayer, who has recently fallen from grace in quality terms by being the director of Suicide Squad.
Yeah, yeah. He did not come out of that on a high note, I don't think.
So we have a guest with us today, James Roberts. James, have you seen End of Watch?
It's been a few years, and I barely remember it. I enjoyed it. I remember that. So it's probably one of the better Ayer films. Certainly better than Suicide Squad.
I don't know what else. What else has Ayer done other than he did the Brad Pitt?
He did Fury.
Fury. That's what it was called.
He also did Sabotage, which was that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Oh, damn it. I don't remember that one. You know, the last Arnold Schwarzenegger movie I saw was the Last Stand or something like
that?
Oh,
with Johnny Knoxville?
I actually liked that movie. And that's
so it was made by this Korean director. And it was like his English. I believe it was the guy who made The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, which is one of my favorite movies in recent history, and I believe that was his first ever English language movie, and I was super excited for it. And then I got Arnold Schwarzenegger and Johnny Knoxville,
Kim Ji Woo, and Forrest Whitaker, and Luis Guzman. Wow,
what a cast!
Our boy Zach Guilford was in it.
That's right,
Saracen.
Yeah, Matt Saracen,
QB one, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah, rightfully so, QB one.
Yeah.
None of that. What was his name? JT.
Oh, the evil one.
Yeah, the one who tried to take over the rich boy.
Remember the Mexican American kid that Buddy Garrity brought home that time, and then who disappeared?
Yes.
James, have you seen Friday Night Lights, the TV series? Do you know what we're talking about?
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't seen it. I do love the book.
Oh God. I have never read the book. I never saw the Billy Bob Thornton movie, but I love the TV series. Anyway, pretty far. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's one of those I've always meant to watch, but just never got around to it.
Oh, it's the best, and it's cool living here in Austin, seeing the random stuff that was in the show.
It honestly, the thing that's best about it is that it actually handles social issues in a way that doesn't feel like an after-school special.
Oh yeah.
It's super grounded and very raw at times, which I really appreciated.
I think was it the first season or second season when Smash was doing steroids?
I think that was the first season.
I think so too. And then Coach Taylor finds out and he just tells him to knock it off and nothing else happens because he doesn't want to jeopardize the team. Anyway,
yeah, that's total Texas football culture. Yeah.
Anyway, we're pretty far afield here. CineSnob presents End of Watch, Alamo Drafthouse, Park North, Monday, February 27th, 7:30 p.m. This is a free screening, but you reserve your seats by purchasing a $5 food and beverage voucher. Just go to drafthouse.com to get your tickets. Let's go ahead and start the show.
In a world filled with movie podcasts, three critics from the juggernaut media market of San Antonio decided to change the entire course of the internet. A feat attempted by many and conquered by many. To produce a relatively listenable podcast. Devastating truth bombs.
Brace yourselves, guys. The Muppets are puppets. You know that, right?
No! Wait! Okay, no!
They're puppets.
Don't ruin it!
And
Muppets are puppets.
This is gonna...
Hard facts.
Yeah, not Kevin Feige or Feig, whatever. But
it's Feig.
I think it's Feige.
Is it really?
I have no idea.
Asking the important questions.
What is that? What was that I just saw right now? It was like a fat Iron Man.
That's a Hulkbuster.
Hulkbuster armor. That's how he
fat
fights
Iron Man.
This is the CineSnob Podcast.
Welcome to episode 95 of the CineSnob Podcast. I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
And our special guest today,
James Roberts.
James is from Glide Magazine and is a contributor to Screen Rant. He's our pal from San Antonio. You like to give Cody the razz, which is always fun.
Yeah, join the line.
You're just so razzable, Cody. Is the thing.
That's what I was voted for in my yearbook, most razzable.
Yeah, but
I was also voted number one with most razzmatazz, so it's, you know,
it evens out.
You have how long have you been writing about movies, James? Let's give a little background here.
I started writing about movies kind of off and on in Austin, excuse me, in a small blog called The Horn, and with Austin Days, a tiny little thing.
Wow.
And then I moved to San Antonio, and my buddy I worked with at The Horn was working with Glide and was like, hey, we need a movie guy. And so I just kind of jumped on that, and I guess that was about 2014, so about 3 years.
Okay, so not terribly long. Not we're all kind of the same age here in this racket. So
except for me, who is significantly younger.
Well,
you're a baby.
When did you graduate from high school? When were you voted most razzable?
I was voted most razzable and most razzmatazz in 2007.
Oh, so that's already 10 years now. So
yeah,
you're right at that like, oh, you're old now, sort of ceiling.
I mean, I'm getting there.
This year is my 20th anniversary of graduating from high school, so that's pretty
cool. So 16 for me.
Ah, well, fuck you both. So
you missed a credit though, Jared, because James is the only non-CineSnob member of the Houston Film Critics Society outside of Houston.
That is right. You were inducted this year, right, James? Or was that late last year? I don't remember.
Late last year, around September, October. I don't remember.
And that's been a real big benefit for Cody and I. I don't know. Were you able to get on the screener list that quickly, or
I got a handful of screeners, but like not enough. I still had to borrow a few from Cody and was mostly just sitting back being jealous of all you guys for all your screeners.
Wait a minute. Cody just violated federal law.
Actually, since he is a member of the society, he is entitled to them. He was just a fourth quarter inductee. So the addresses are taken back in June, July, around then when he was not voted in. So fooey on you.
Just wait, James, until you get so many, you're like, oh, fuck, I can't possibly watch these. Who is it? Who is it that sends like a big giant envelope?
Magnolia sends an envelope of like 20 movies, and you're just like, nope.
I can't pause. Like, there's one or two like in there that you've heard of, and the others are like a lot of really small time docs, I think is the.
Well, and Magnolia, and to be fair, Magnolia does make great stuff, but there are a lot of small docs, and they also are part of Magnet, which does horror. So you get a lot of small horrors in there too. And that's horror, not small whores.
Oh, man, I could use a small whore right now, let me tell you.
Who couldn't?
Who couldn't? Anyway, thanks for joining us, James.
Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
It's been Cody and I bouncing off of each other for the last, God, it's got to be the last 6 months at least since our pal Kiko has made it on the show. Who, for the record, I contacted very, very early today on two different means of communication, and he did not get back to me. So,
right.
If anybody,
yeah. So he has lost his privileges.
Well, it's always welcome. I'm just trying to get him to come on because we all saw Logan early, and we all have lots of stuff to say about it. I don't want to give away what we think about it, but we have lots of stuff to say about it. And since this is the first time I can remember that Kiko's legitimately been excited about a comic book movie, I really wanted to hear his take on this, but where are you, Kiko? You didn't message me back. You're not on Skype. Let me look. Make sure.
You know what he's probably doing? He's probably too busy making clever political memes.
Those are some big time dad jokes.
That's a joke for a very select few people listening here, but you and I have a constant back and forth throughout the day commenting on Kiko's various political bits of political humor.
I love Kiko's sense of humor. It's like no other, but it is like, come on, man. Like some of these jokes are way too old. Like he made a Sanjaya reference, that being Sanjaya Malakar, a noted, I don't know, was he a bad contestant or was he just a weird contestant on American Idol like 10 years ago?
He was bad, but he got sent through because he was mad adorbs. So because the ladies loved him, they kept on voting him through, even though he was not very good.
So he made a reference to that in reference to Donald Trump. And I was like, and you pointed out to me, and I was like, oh, man, that's not even like Norm Macdonald, like anti-humor funny.
No,
it's just an old joke.
He also, when he's supposed to be working, apparently, I don't know, I don't think he did it at work, but he made this Photoshop of Donald Trump sitting on a toilet, like from, and it's from Dumb and Dumber.
Yes, when Harry's taking like a massive shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I don't know.
I laughed at that one, I'm not going to lie.
Well, aren't you, you have some stepkids, right? James.
I do.
So you're like half. You've got that dad humor in your blood. So maybe that's why.
It's weird how much like it's almost like a switch that goes off as soon as there's kids around.
With Cody and I, Cody and I have no kids, so we don't function on that wavelength. But you and Kiko, the dad jokes.
No, we do sugar dad humor.
Ew.
No,
I think it's supposed to say sugar daddy. Sugar dad just sounds like. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's like, old man.
I don't think that's. Is that what you call your dad? Sugar dad?
No, it's not. Not in some years.
Ooh. Anyway, so, do we have anything else to intro out of the way here? Do we have any?
No, just busting Kiko's balls.
We welcomed Kiko. Look. The only reason Kiko hasn't been on the show is because he hasn't contacted me back and doesn't ever know what time it's happening. Like he's always invited, but you know, someone's going to give him, he's going to give a sob story one day about how he wasn't invited to talk about Logan, the one comic book movie he's actually excited about. And you know, read your messages, Kiko. I saw it was delivered.
Yeah, and this is the first time, too, that we've ever had a guest on the show. Like, we've been talking about it for a while, and almost like the parent that's threatening the child with punishment.
You mean a guest like critic? James is our first guest
like
critic.
Like a third person.
Yeah.
Which is something we should probably do more often, considering the lack of interest on his part.
So you got anything? You got any shit you want to talk about Kiko, James, while you're here?
You know, I miss him as much as you guys. I don't see him at screenings much anymore.
He likes to go like late Saturday nights to pick up on things.
He'll do like the 11:30 showing. He did an 11:30 showing of Silence, which is like a 3-hour movie. I'm like, are you insane?
Jesus.
So enough of that. Let's go ahead and move on to some news.
It's time for the real rundown, recapping this week in movie news.
So first up, the saga of the Batman continues. Cody, your boy, Matt Reeves, director of Let Me In, Cloverfield, and one of my favorite movies of the past few years, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, was in talks to direct this film. Originally, this was supposed to be a Ben Affleck written and directed film starring Ben Affleck as the Batman, and Affleck waffled on directing and officially stepped down a few weeks ago, and apparently the script isn't in the right shape either, and and it's supposed to be rewritten. And then they were going to bring in Matt Reeves to direct this movie, and now he seems to be out. It's not official yet, but he seems to be out. Yeah. What the hell do you think is wrong with this movie?
Well, I mean, and I'm actually glad that we have James on today because I just know from talking to him personally, and he'll get to it in a minute. I'm sure that he wants the DC universe to work so bad, and I think it's adorable because
I want it to work. I do want it to work too. I really do,
dude. But everything that they've done so far has been a train wreck, and I think that it just it's and Jared, you and I have talked about this at length. But DC does not have – they're not like a well-oiled machine like Marvel is. They don't have a singular vision in the way that they do in Marvel. And so you have a bunch of people who are not – who are just doing their own shit without helming everything else. So like it's supposed to be Zack Snyder on some level, but he is – I think he's kind of proven that he's not capable of that.
I don't know that it's honestly – not anybody doing it, but I feel like it's like a boardroom at Warner Brothers that's making the decisions.
That, right. Yeah, that's...
I feel like Warner Brothers is so busy hand-wringing and like worrying about what these movies are instead of just letting them be. And I think that's the major difference is because Disney has that very hands-off approach with Marvel and just lets Marvel do what Marvel does. The MCU works so well because they're, you know, operating like they do in the comic books with the crossover stories and the thread that you have to maintain throughout all of them. But like DC seems so hamstrung by Warner Brothers' inability to just let go of control. And I think that's the major problem.
I think we talked about this, Cody, you and I, when we talked about Suicide Squad and even certain parts of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, that there's so much of this stuff that feels like a panic move in those first two big movies. Like, I guarantee you, in no script written ever, is there a fucking 5-minute scene of Wonder Woman checking her email. You know, that was a boardroom decision. Like, we have to let these people know Aquaman and Cyborg and the Flash are coming. So she's going to watch some YouTube clips. And then Suicide Squad, it's a narrative mess. You know, and a lot of people have a problem with the tone on both of these films. And I don't, frankly, I don't think the tone is something they can't overcome. I think both of these movies, and James, I don't know if you agree. I think these are both tonally fine. I mean, they may not be your cup of tea, but I think the biggest problem is they're just not well-told stories.
I agree with the tone. I like the dark tone that DC is taking. I think it's a nice contrast to Marvel. And if they could, you know, again, just let them kind of do what they're going to do, it would work better. I think it's interesting because with Dawn of Justice, like, it's kind of a narrative mess. And, like, when I saw it in the theater, I got the impression that there were scenes and scenes of exposition missing. and then when... Like, did either of you watch the director's cut? Cody, I know you haven't.
I did. Yeah, I did watch the extended edition. It's like 3 hours long.
But I think that it works better as a story. It still has its problems, but I think it fixed like 60-75% of my problems with that movie.
Do they still bond over having their mother with the same name?
Yeah, I mean, what they cut and added back in for the extended edition seems to be mostly like the first hour and a half of the film.
It's necessary parts of the story, I think. It makes it all make more sense. Now, whether or not the story is still stupid, we could debate that, but it makes more sense from like a narrative perspective.
I definitely agree with that. It does clean up some stuff. I still think there's some stupid choices in there. However, getting back to the point, I think most people can agree that Ben Affleck is the bright spot in the film, no matter what you thought of the film. His take on Batman and the way they portrayed the Batman character in that film is, you know, rises to the top of whatever shittiness level you think the Batman Superman was.
Which is why the Ben Affleck Batman solo standalone movie was seen to be this. Maybe it's the thing that actually jumpstarts this franchise and moves it in the right direction, especially because of Affleck's track record. I mean, Live by Night was horrible, but
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's not good. But you know, Affleck in Affleck's hands. I mean, there's no question that Ben Affleck is a fantastic filmmaker, regardless of his latest dud. But then you have him like. There had been talks for a while before he even dropped out as director that he had been floundering on the character as a whole, and just I think in just being tied down to everything and directing and acting and all of that. And so you know you have it's just happening in increments that kind of to me, and this is pure speculation, but to me it seems like maybe some of that's true because now he's backed out as director because he wanted to focus on acting or writing or whatever the hell, and then they get Matt Reeves who. I mean, let's be honest. If you're going to lose Affleck as a director, someone who is as on fire as Matt Reeves right now, like if you're talking about like directors of studio movies, like what he did with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was astonishing what he was able to pull off with that.
Yeah.
And of course, I love Cloverfield tremendously. God, we don't need to go through that again.
God damn it.
We don't have to go through that again. It's the best. It's the perfect monster movie. But anyway.
the perfect one?
Yes. Yes,
where is it ranked on found footage? Is it the perfect found footage movie too?
I mean, yeah, I would say it's the best found footage movie too. You know, but you know, that's another show. That's for my other podcast, Cody's Cloverfield Conundrum, which is where I talk about how all other movies can't live up. But but anyway, so the idea that they have this guy in Matt Reeves who. Is really doing great work, and you know the thing about Matt Reeves I like as a director is that like he doesn't half-ass anything, like he goes for it every time, and like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a super bold movie when you think about it. I mean, what the movie opens on a long extended scene of apes with no talking or humans or anything like that, you know. Well, maybe it doesn't open it. Whatever, but anyway.
Come on, stick the landing on your fucking blowjob for Matt Reeves.
Well, it's more like sticky the landing, but anyway. Oh, okay, you know. So anyway, so anyway, the idea that now Matt Reeves is backing out, I sort of wonder if maybe he knows that this thing is a mess, and maybe. It can't be salvaged, or maybe he knows that Affleck is trying to get out of playing Batman, and maybe that's why talks broke down. Because again, I think that Matt Reeves is someone who's only going to put himself his hat in the ring if he knows that he can put 100% into something. And so I do wonder if maybe this is a signal that the movie is as in bad a shape as we think it might be, or if maybe Affleck is trying to get out of it.
Well, this isn't the first time a director has left of DC movie. Do you both recall? I think The Flash is on like two. It's lost two directors now.
Yeah, they're on director number three.
Because it was.
Did they find the third director?
I don't know who is. Have we heard about a director that's come on board?
Because Seth. Oh, look.
I know Seth Graham Green was supposed to be the director. I think he was the first.
Yeah, and
one
then it was
left.
The guy who made Dope was supposed to take
that's
over.
Right. And look, here's my speculation, and this is just how I feel. This has no basis in any kind of expertise at all. I feel like this whole Ben Affleck as Batman thing started because Warner Brothers wanted to keep Ben Affleck happy. You know, he had just come off of Argo, it won an Oscar, won a few Oscars, right? How many Oscars did it win?
It won Best Picture. Well, it won Best Picture and Screenplay for sure.
Right. So they bring him on. They want to keep him happy. You know, he's got a soft spot for Batman, apparently. And then they fuck up Batman v Superman. And then he fucks up, or they fuck up, or it's a total fuck up of Live by Night, which I haven't seen yet. Have you seen it, James?
Yeah, it was... a mess.
So,
yeah.
And part of that, at least in stuff I've been reading, is the kind of rollout of it was not great either. You know, is the speculation. Anyway, so now the relationship between Affleck and Warner Brothers is strained. the giving Batman, giving the director director's chair to Affleck was a favor, and now I guess they're both maybe they're both seeing it's not the right choice, so they let him walk. But now that he wants all the way out, I don't know. Look, they'll survive it. There's no one in this franchise at all, other than arguably, I think, Margot Robbie, who needs to stay on board. I mean, it would be a PR hit for, you know, a month if Affleck left as Batman. But at the end of the day, even the movies that critics thought were pieces of shit in Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad made mega money. Now, they didn't make like $1 billion worldwide, but they still made like $750 million and $800 million worldwide. So it's not something that they can necessarily not overcome, I don't think, if Affleck leaves. I mean, Matt Reeves leaving is kind of shattered my last bit of hope that this was something that was going to be good. I assume there's going to be a Batman movie in the next 2 years. If Affleck's not starring in it, I would not be surprised. If he is, I would be just the same surprise. I would probably think that would be his last one. I don't know what to make of this. I don't know what the hell DC is doing. I mean, I
have to wonder if it's not a script issue. Like, I know Affleck's been working hard on the script for like a year now, it seems like. And I wonder if they're just trying to change it and Affleck doesn't want to budge on that. And that's what's causing the strain.
I guess. I mean, I just wonder how they can keep this going. I mean, look, it's easy to sit on the sidelines and go, what the fuck are they doing? But, you know, without knowing the machinations of how the negotiations are going and how many shareholders they have to satisfy. But Warner Brothers has made great films, and I think whatever you think of the Harry Potter series as a, you know, film by film, that's something they've done right by. And how they can't do right by something that's completely in-house in DC stuff is really baffling. How they waffle so much. Even Harry Potter, you know, Harry Potter had, what, four directors before they settled on David Yates? Who became like the house director, apparently. You know, not apparently, but, you know, for lack of a better word. And they've kept that with the same sensibility, the same look, the same feel. You know, that's basically their version of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is this long, now 9-movie series.
But that's... Not to interrupt, but that's sort of kind of like the TV mindset, right? Where you get a really big director to do your pilot, and then now that you've established the visual look and the way things are, everyone kind of follows suit and you're creating a cohesive project, even though you can swap out directors in and out.
Well, I don't know that it's I don't know that it's that. I mean, I wouldn't call Chris Columbus a big director. I mean, I guess
right,
it's okay.
but visually, other than getting a little bit darker and playing with the color tones, hasn't the Harry Potter series been pretty consistent across the board? Even when like Cuarón was directing to Yates, I mean,
I think if you want to call anyone the big name pilot director that set the tone, I think it's Cuarón. But that was shit. That was 14 years ago now. I mean, it hasn't been, or 13 years ago. It's the thing has still gone on with Yates at the helm. I think through now Fantastic Beasts.
I think the difference there is that you, with Harry Potter and now Fantastic Beasts, you've got, to a certain degree, the creator of the series and the franchise, like with a large amount of say and kind of direction. Whereas with like DC, there are thousands and thousands of stories and thousands of different interpretations of these characters, and they're trying to build from the ground up. Whereas with Harry Potter, they had the framework laid out already. True. They just had to follow that.
Well, I guess, you know, in a sense, though, I feel like they have the framework for all of this stuff, too. But I feel like they're so intent on reverse engineering the formula that Marvel put together. And look, I've said this before. It's tempting to call them in direct competition, you know, Marvel versus DC making these films, but they're not really, you know, it's two different things happening at two different times. You know, it's like you know, an NBA game isn't necessarily conflicting with an NFL game. You know, does that make sense to anybody else, or am I just talking out of my ass?
We have talked about this line of logic you have a dozen times and how I don't agree with it. So
the movies aren't coming out on the same day. So it's not like you have to see, you have to choose between Batman versus Superman or Captain America Civil War. Like there's no.
Right. But there is a quality difference to which they are pitted against each other.
Well, right. But that doesn't really matter. I mean, it does to fans, and it does if the attendance starts dying off, if ticket sales go lower and lower. Suicide Squad made more money than Batman v Superman, and I think Suicide Squad is a way worse movie. Occasionally you get the merging of great storytelling and commercial viability, and I think that's what the Marvel Universe is. Then a lot of other times you get shitty storytelling, but amazing commercial viability, like the Transformers series. None of those are good movies. They've all made more than a fucking $1 billion worldwide at the box office. You know, I would hope that DC rights its ship enough that we aren't talking about it in terms of that. We're talking about it in terms of, hey, this is a good movie and it made $1 billion. You know, but the more I see of them, the way they're treating directors and the way they're treating, someone like Ben Affleck, you know, who's waffling back and forth, the less and less I think that's likely. I don't know what either of you think, but
I mean, I think I agree with that. And I think it's not even Batman. I think it's just look at the fact that we talked about earlier that The Flash is on its third director and like it's supposed to shoot, I think, this year. And I don't think they have a director. And so it is clearly something where either the people, the execs at Warner Brothers or in DC or whoever is calling the shots here are not getting everything into the right. I feel like maybe there's a miscommunication between the people who are taking these movies over and what Warner Brothers wants, because obviously you wouldn't have directors leave unless it was a creative difference. And you're on now the third bit of creative difference there. You have Matt Reeves, who, as far as I'm concerned, was a huge get when it was announced that it was Matt Reeves. I think that a lot of people in our world were like, okay, I'm back in. I'm suddenly interested in this again, and maybe this is the guy who can do it. And then within 2 or 3 days, he's out. So I just feel like there is no cohesiveness to anything involving DC right now, and they can't even get on the same page as their directors because they're having to hire 2 or 3 per movie. So now technically Batman is on its third director, if you want to look at it that way. So it's, you know, again, I don't think that signs are pointing in a good direction at all.
What they need to do is take the, because Marvel is all basically, you know, controlled by Kevin Feige, who worked with Marvel for a long time. He knows how Marvel stories works and how the universe works. I do think there's too much interference from Warner Brothers. They need to let Geoff Johns have more control over DC, almost singular control, and just let him do his thing because he knows how DC Comics works. He's guided them through, you know, New 52 and now Rebirth in the comic books. And even if you look at like the CW shows, the difference, like, and it's mind-boggling that like the CW is doing a better job than Warner Brothers in presenting these characters and these stories. That just doesn't make any sense. But I think it comes down to Geoff Johns.
Yeah, I'm curious to wonder. I'm curious to know just if they really give a shit. You know, because I assume, you know, there's pride of ownership when you give essentially like a, you know, Kevin Feige is the showrunner of Marvel. The Marvel Cinematic Universe. DC doesn't have that, or at least not by any kind of stretch of the imagination, someone who can overrule some dumb decision.
Just to add to that, not only has that happened, but I think something that is important to mention as well is that, before you move on, is that it's not only that and that it's sort of being shepherded there, but when you're talking about Marvel in particular, they have been able to hand the reins off twice now to the creative filmmaking side of things, where it was Jon Favreau running everything, who handed it off to Joss Whedon, who has now handed it off to the Russo brothers. And it's been seamless. The transitions have been seamless there. And I think not only just as a on like a macro level with what Feige's doing, but putting it in the filmmaking creative hands of people who are now ushering in these things and kind of overseeing things.
Well, I don't think that every single Marvel movie is seamless. I feel like both Favreau and Whedon were out because they ran out of gas.
Well, yeah, but what I mean, I don't mean that the movies are seamless. I mean the transition of power of who's, because remember they were flying Joss Whedon in to like fix, I think it was maybe Thor, where they brought Joss Whedon in for a few days,
right? But his, do you remember when he left? He was like, I couldn't deal with this anymore. Like,
well, that's because Age of Ultron was a disaster.
Well, but it was, but both he and Favreau left on those. Both he and Favreau left on big studio interfering, like films that had giant studio interference. You know, Favreau's Iron Man 2 was full of setup for the Avengers, and Age of Ultron famously has that Thor hot tub scene that doesn't mean anything. You remember that? that Whedon argued against including, but was forced to include. Otherwise he'd have to lose his, the Hawkeye, Linda Cardellini, whatever that was.
Yeah. Farmhouse. But haven't bullshit. But don't you think that the Russo brothers have had a fairly smooth, because the Russo brothers basically got their test of the Avengers with Civil War.
Oh,
and
I mean, I love both of those movies that they've done, but I still think that there's a little too much. We talked about this when we talked about Civil War. I think there's a little too much all the time in Marvel planting the seeds for what's to come next. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it works fine. Sometimes it doesn't. Like for example, I don't like Iron Man 2. I don't like Age of Ultron. Because I feel like that's where the studio got up its own ass and wanted to. Did we lose James?
I think I might have lost him.
Oh,
hello.
Oh. Hey, there you are. I heard a little Skype. I heard a little Skype noise, and
I don't know what happened. Sorry.
No, that's cool. You're good. All right.
No, we're probably petering out anyway.
Anyway, I hope they write the ship, Cody. I'm sure you don't give a shit at this point.
Man, as far as I'm concerned. They are in, look, I mean, if Zack Snyder is the guy who's making Justice League, then that gives me no hope in anything. So I don't think that it's going to be resolved anytime soon until the guy who has made two, shitty movies is out and he's arguably the one who's still at the helm of bringing them all together, which at this point, I just don't care. I mean, I just really don't care about any of those characters. I don't think that they're establishing them well. So,
James, yeah. James, do you think it's salvageable at this point?
No, I don't. I think it all hinges on Batman, and because shockingly, Affleck was like the least worst thing about Batman versus Superman.
Yeah,
and like if they can't even like get that going, then what the fuck else is going on?
Oh, God, I agree. Hey, but they've sold a shitload of Harley Quinn stuff, so it's all gold for them.
Hooray.
Hey. Let's go ahead and move on to reviews.
Here are this week's reviews.
First up this week, we have Logan.
Hey to Mr. Monson. You understand you're trespassing right now, right?
I have an easement with the previous owner of your property.
Previous being the operative word. Who's this?
It's the guy telling you to get back in your nice truck and go play Okie Dickhead somewhere else.
Hey, Carl. It looks like Mr. Monson hired some muscle.
Looks that way.
He's a friend of mine.
Friend with a big mouth.
I hear that a lot.
And you probably hear this, too.
More than I'd like.
And you know the drill. I'm gonna count to three. And you're going to start walking away.
I got rights to this one.
One.
I have a lawyer now.
Two.
Three.
You all right, boss?
You know the drill. Get the hell out of here.
In the near future, a weary Logan cares for an ailing Professor X in a hideout on the Mexican border. But Logan's attempts to hide from the world and his legacy are upended when a young mutant arrives, pursued by dark forces. Cody, Logan.
This is a little bit earlier than we normally do reviews because we've all seen it and it's all anyone's going to be talking about for the next couple weeks. So
yeah,
why not?
Normally we do these the week of the release, but we're 2 weeks out right now and our embargo lifted. We saw the screening early and everybody's talking about Logan. So we're going to talk about Logan. God damn
it. If you're listening to this and you're worried about spoilers, we will not spoil it until you are given warning.
Yes.
And we will protect you. We will protect your ears. So I don't even know where to start with this movie because I've honestly been thinking about it since it ended.
So let's start with last year's offering of X films. We've all seen Deadpool and X-Men Apocalypse, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So can we agree that Deadpool is great?
James doesn't agree with that.
James,
that's
right. I forgot. James is a virulent anti-X-Men fan.
Yes.
But at least Cody, you and I agree that Deadpool is great and Apocalypse is a piece of dog shit.
I think that's being kind to Apocalypse. I think it's like a piece of dog shit that is stuck to your shoe, and then you when you put your shoe back down, you step in more dog shit.
So, you take Apocalypse. Your shoe off and you step in dog shit barefoot.
Exactly.
Or in your socks foot, even worse. So this is the 10th, I guess, technically 10th X-Men film. This is the 9th one that that Hugh Jackman has played the role of Wolverine in, if you don't count his cardboard cutout mask in Deadpool.
Which we shouldn't.
We shouldn't. We won't. But I think safe to say his best turn as Wolverine / Logan.
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
I think that maybe you get the feeling and you get the sense of watching this that he stuck around this long because he knew that they had this movie in them, and he stuck around so he could make this movie because what this feels like is a completely uncompromised vision. This feels like the creative team behind this movie was told by Fox, look, go out with a bang and make the best movie that you can, and they pulled out all the stops. And I was telling, I think both of you, I cannot think of an example of a major studio saying go for it more than they did with this movie. And
well, I mean, it has Deadpool and Deadpool alone to thank for the freedom that they got for this movie.
I agree. I think that that allowed them to have no studio interference because Deadpool proved that you can have a rated R and like, don't get me wrong. The tone of Deadpool and the tone of this movie could not be any different, but they have the freedom to create this, with Fox and with X-Men and go dark with it and know that they could still make a lot of money and it be financially successful. But this Logan is completely dark. I mean, like, this makes Christopher Nolan's Batman look, you know, like My Little Pony. Like, it's like it is.
It is
unbelievably dark, and it is relentlessly dark too. It does not get lighter. There is not a bit of sunshine in this entire movie. So it's not only dark; it is crazy violent in a way that somehow is still not gratuitous. Where it seems like something like John Wick, where you're watching 2 hours of headshots, you know. So
it's essentially as violent as you always expected Wolverine to be, but was restrained because he was restrained by the PG-13 rating.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, getting their arms sliced off.
Yeah, and you're getting claws through their skulls and stuff like that. It's badass. But anyway. I think that the thing that you can talk about all you want about how it's the best comic book movie ever made, and it is, and I don't think that that's – I honestly don't find that up for debate, and in my opinion, because I think that it accomplishes a few different things. First of all, on its own merits, taking away comic book movie as part of it, I think that actually limits it because it's an incredible film. Like, it's well-written. It's well-acted. It's thought provoking. The tone of this movie is so perfect, and Jackman is great in it. Patrick Stewart is really great in it.
Yeah.
And it just does these things that you normally see any other movie fumble and does it right. So like the example is the use of a kid. The little girl in this film, like how many times do you see like supposedly badass kids or evil kids or any type of kids who are supposed to really mean something and it's fumbled? And this is an example of a kid that they get exactly right, where it's like this is a character that she's capable of anything, and you don't know what's going to happen the next scene because she's capable of anything. And the other thing is the movie. And I think that James and I were kind of talking about this before, but it's a movie where, you know, you're kind of watching it and you're either trying to be like to really dig into it and go, OK, maybe I don't like that as much. Or you're saying something like, I really like this a lot. I really don't want them to mess this up. And it's amazing how it starts off great. And I was actually a little bit worried. I'm like, I'm loving this right now. Please, I hope that it doesn't falter anywhere. And it just doesn't. It maintains its pace. It maintains its quality throughout, down to the last shot of the movie. And it's just like it is stunningly well made and executed. And beyond just limiting it as an X-Men movie, it's a really good movie that I could see being a top 10 contender by the end of the year.
James, best comic book movie ever?
You know, I'm going to agree with that. And I feel weird saying that because, like, I've been such a vocal detractor of the X-Men series since the first one. I've always thought they were, like, fun.
I think we gave you shit on Facebook for the revisionist history on X2.
You know, X2, I think, is one of the better X-Men movies, honestly.
You were still
Right, absolutely.
At the time, it was probably the best comic book movie ever made. There's been a lot of best comic book movies ever made in the last 17 years.
Yeah, they keep one-upping themselves, don't they?
For the record, I still have to put The Dark Knight right over Logan, but just barely. Anyway,
I'd accept either answer. I don't think either answer's wrong.
Yeah. I may be a little more excited for Logan right now, but I think my heart will forever belong to The Dark Knight.
I think that The Dark Knight has more flaws than Logan has.
Let's not get into that right now, but there are flaws in both of them, and I think being a little overlong is one of them, and kind of laggy second acts, but I think they both overcome them very well. Anyway, James, what do you think of Logan?
Again, I loved it. My problem with the X-Men franchise has always been narrative. The story has never resonated with me. It's always kind of lost me. I've always thought it was kind of silly and dumb. X2, I guess, sure. Days of Future Past, I loved. But the rest of them, like, kind of max out at okay, I guess. This one, from, like, the very first shot to the very last shot, I was riveted. And I actively tried to hate it because I went in with a chip on my shoulder. Like, I was talking a lot of shit beforehand. You guys saw.
Right.
But I actually was blown away. I don't eat my words often, but wow. What an incredible movie.
So I'm on the same boat with the two of you. I loved it from beginning to end. Jackman has always been, and I think – you know, it's funny if you've heard the story. I don't know if either of you have. When it came to casting the part of Wolverine in the first X-Men movie, the first choice was, and I think he was actually cast, was Dougray Scott, who, due to scheduling conflicts, could not get out of shooting.
Wait, who?
Yeah, exactly. Right. No, Dougray Scott. What was he in recently? I literally have
no idea who you're talking about.
He was in Hitman. He was in Taken 3. He's had a very, very not so great, you know, kind of a journeyman career since then. Anyway, he was coming off of that Drew Barrymore, like, super 90s girly retelling of Cinderella called Ever After. And he was shooting Mission Impossible 2, I believe he was the bad guy in Mission Impossible 2, the worst of the Mission Impossibles. And he couldn't, like, scheduling conflicts, he couldn't get to shoot X-Men, so they cast Jackman. And Jackman became a megastar because of this. I mean, a career-making performance as Wolverine. Legitimately the best part of pretty much every X-Men movie he's been in, I think. I mean, I don't think there's much up for debate on that. And he's been in some pieces of shit, like X-Men Origins Wolverine. A lot of people hate X-Men 3. I don't. I do not like X-Men Origins, and I do not like X-Men Apocalypse. But anyway, this is, you know, we'll talk about this later in the spoiler zone. This is allegedly Jackman's last turn as Wolverine. I don't know if I buy that 100%.
Well, there has been word that Ryan Reynolds is trying to get a Wolverine and Deadpool movie off the ground.
Right. I mean, he's so good in the role. I mean, he literally 100% owns Wolverine. Like, there's no one. I can't even fathom recasting Wolverine. Everybody else in the films, it's fine. I don't give a shit. This one is one of those characters that's incredibly defined by an actor, which is strange because, you know, it was such a popular character before that. You know, Wolverine, James, I don't know, were you into comic books and stuff in the 90s? I mean, obviously.
I was into comic books, and I loved the animated series. That was my shit every Saturday. I woke up, watched X-Men.
There was nothing, comic book-wise, there was nothing bigger than the X-Men in the 90s. And I think a lot of people don't really realize that now, you know, because that first film was coming off of a decade of dominance, and there was a lot of potential to get it wrong. And that was back when everybody was self-conscious and didn't think about putting them in, you know, he would never, bleh. They would never put Wolverine in a yellow costume now, or back then everything was black leather. And anyway, I just love this movie from beginning to end. I love that it doesn't seem to give a shit about where it takes place in what timeline. Cause I think if you try to reconcile this with any of the X-Men movie timelines that are out there. Yeah.
That is an exact point that James made to me. James, you remember what you were saying about that?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, that's a question that I keep getting, is what timeline does it take into? And it's like, it doesn't matter. one of the things I think that it does well, does that device where movies use, where they just kind of reference a thing that's happened without explaining it.
Yes.
And then go on. And I love that Logan does that. Like, we don't know what happened. Doesn't matter. This is this movie. Focus on it.
And it drops a few, like, you know, little tidbits of stuff that happen. I think maybe there's maybe one or two that go a little too far, you know, in kind of this world building that doesn't, you know, it kind of, in a sense, begs more questions when it brings those up, but I don't think it's anything, you know, that indicts the movie as bad or anything. I mean, just like both of you said, just I don't think that I was looking for something to be upset with, but I feel like I was with Cody, like, okay, they can't possibly fuck this up, can they? I hope they don't fuck this up. Hope they don't fuck this up. And they didn't, and they pulled it off, and I think it's time to delve into the spoiler zone. What do you guys think? So we can start talking about the plot of this filmy.
It's have we graduated from the talkies to the filmy?
Yeah, let's go ahead and move into the spoiler zone.
Now entering the spoiler zone. To avoid spoilers, fast forward to
1 hour, 2 minutes, and 16 seconds.
All right, so as we mentioned, this is allegedly Jackman's final performance as Wolverine, not the least of which because the character finally dies at the end of the film.
Yeah, which is interesting because we all know that, you know, going in that it's supposed to be Jackman's last kind of run as Wolverine, and you know that he's old and aging and everything, and so you kind of go into the movie. I mean, I went into the movie thinking he was going to die, and I wasn't.
I wasn't shocked at all. I don't, James. How about you?
Yeah, no, that's totally expected.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean that the moment doesn't hit. And I think that especially given what we know about him and Laura, the little girl, who, again, we should mention, is fucking awesome in this movie all around.
Daphne Keene is her name. She's another breakout young female star of last year, Millie Bobby Brown, English Spanish actress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who, I guess she's about 11 or 12 years old as well. Those two need to make a movie together.
That would be awesome. That's a good idea. Hollywood, we know you're listening.
But just about ponies or something.
Yeah.
Something really stupid.
So anyway, I think it was, and it becomes earned because of the relationship that's built there. And, it happens. What I like about the movie is that pretty much they kill off two major characters because Professor X also gets it.
Yeah.
But it happens in ways that are kind of unceremonious. I mean, they just kind of, Wolverine essentially gets, completely brutally murdered by
a bad Wolverine.
By evil Wolverine, and then Professor X also gets murdered by him in that state. But I think that the way that they handle the death of Wolverine is punctuated perfectly by the last shot of the movie, which is they bury Wolverine and then they've got a cross and then they turn it over to an X and kind of linger on that and then go to black. And I was like, holy shit, that is the best possible way to end this movie.
I got chills.
I did too.
That feels weird for me to say about an X-Men movie, but that was perfect.
Yeah, I too loved that ending. I loved that. One of the things I was expecting to happen in the film that didn't, and I'm really glad it didn't, was a cameo by another character. Another mutant character, someone we'd seen before. They finally transport Daphne's her real name, Laura, to the Eden compound in North Dakota, and someone like Halle Berry is waiting there for them. I would have bet you something like that was going to happen, and I'm really glad it didn't. I'm really glad they kept this movie small, and this is the first time in a long time that it hasn't been someone fighting in an X-Men film, someone fighting someone who's going to end the world. I think that's one of the things the X-Men got away from in the more recent films. The first films, they kept it small. They were fighting for mutants. And then with something like, Days of Future Past, and especially Apocalypse, they're fighting an end of the world thing. This is a road movie that's very much a small movie. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that it's intimate. There isn't a big giant cast of characters. There's no threat to humanity or threat to mutant kind or whatever. It's the threat to a little girl who is super badass and could take care of herself anyway. It's about Logan's legacy and about, what he's been and what he'll be remembered for. And I just loved it. There's not much more I can say about it.
Well, I mean,
I think they should use it as the basis for whatever this series becomes. Like, I know after Apocalypse, there was some talk about rebooting again. I don't know if that's still going on. I think they're still trying to get Sophie Turner to play Phoenix, which sounds dumb, but whatever.
She was terrible in Apocalypse, by the way.
I agree, but everything in Apocalypse was terrible. But they have the perfect setup now for like an entire new franchise with new characters, new situations, a new timeline. And I honestly feel like they would be best served if Logan was the basis for that. And that way, making this movie sort of like a passing of the torch.
Well, and what's funny is that you say that is that when I was thinking back to how they could mess it up while I was watching, I remember thinking at one point in the movie, I was loving it so much, and I'm like, man, if they go to Eden and Logan takes over and becomes like this, the new nice professor who's teaching this new group of mutants, I'm like, please don't do that. Like, please just kill him.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that they ended it the way that it did. And then, I think that a big element of it too is, like you said, it is kind of a road trip movie, but it's got Patrick Stewart as kind of a, like Professor X in a way that you like would never normally expect him to be, given everything Patrick Stewart has done with the role.
Well,
the reason that it works, and again, they're all cursing the whole time, and
I love hearing Patrick Stewart say the word fuck. Yes, I love that so much.
And he does it a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
But the reason that it works is because, and to their credit, they have built this nasty dystopian setting that they live in, where like Wolverine is he's such a tortured character from beginning to end in this movie. Like he actively doesn't want to be alive. And Professor X is in terrible shape, and they're having to kind of keep him
he's the most
drugged and medicated.
He's essentially the most powerful mutant in the world who is losing control of his power because he has dementia or something, some sort of degenerative brain disease, and he can't control it. And that's causing like these massive like psychic seizures to happen that are nearly like ripping people apart. And it's just it's a really effective visual and a really good tool that it uses to kind of show that this guy who's a superhero is falling victim to a very real like old man disease. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, I don't know if either of you agree with me, but it's interesting to me how, you know, despite what you think of the films that came before this, how much this movie owes to those, and the relationship between Jackman and Stewart owes to what we know came before. You know, it's great performances by both of them. I think Patrick Stewart is fantastic in this movie. But that they couldn't, I don't feel like they could have made this movie and it could have resonated without everything that we know that came before it. Even though this doesn't seem to be really that associated with everything, this feels like, even though it's not a, you know, there's no direct through line, it feels like a season finale. I don't know if that makes sense to either of you.
I'd call it more of a series finale because series it is very final.
I meant series finale. You're right. Yeah. Like this is like,
damn it, Jared.
I fucked it up. God damn it.
Cody. Yeah. Welcome to the CineSnob podcast,
yeah,
James.
Yeah. You fuck it up all the time.
Now leaving the spoiler zone.
All right, guys. Grades for Logan. James.
A.
Cody.
A-.
A minus. It's an A for me all the way. Why? What could have been better for you, Cody? You have some weird bullshit, I know.
Yeah, it's best not to get. It's just my grading system more than anything else.
You wanted Matt Reeves to direct it.
Yeah, if Matt Reeves would have directed this, this would have been an A+. Especially if the Cloverfield monster would have made an appearance.
Oh God! All right, let's go ahead and move on to our next movie, The Great Wall. I just want to apologize for that clip because there's only a couple clips out there on the EPK website, and I hate playing audio clips that are just like action sounds and like monsters eating people with no dialogue, so I apologize. Anyway, in this movie, a pair of European mercenaries searching for black powder become embroiled in the defense of the Great Wall of China against a horde of monstrous creatures. James, you saw this. Cody didn't. What'd you think?
It was really disappointing, and I think philosophically, because this movie represented a great opportunity for the coming together of the Hollywood scene and the Chinese movie scene to make something truly original and truly poignant, and they fucked it up with an awful script.
We were talking about this, you and I, on Facebook. This is weirdly, it's an American generated script. It's a pair of writers that wrote, what did they write? I wrote this in my review and I can't remember. Some piece of shit. anyway,
several pieces of shit.
Several pieces of shit, but Matt Damon's frequent Bourne collaborator Tony Gilroy apparently took a pass at this too. Excuse me. You know, I don't know if you feel the same way. Oh, these guys wrote The Prince of Persia and Swords of Sorcerer's Apprentice, so you know we were in right. good hands from the get go. So this to me felt like. Regardless of who, despite who wrote it, it felt like a Chinese movie they had dropped Matt Damon in. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I think, I guess visually, especially, yes. And it did feel a lot like the Chinese martial arts cinema. But yeah, you're right. The American generated script just totally took me out of that completely.
So, were you familiar with the director, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, Yimou Zhang, I would assume. Have you seen like House of Flying Daggers and Hero? Because I have.
Yes, I have. I love those movies. They're fantastic. I think they're beautiful. They're so much fun. They represent, I think, the peak of Chinese cinema, especially in like the last decade or so, or I guess 15 years. But
and are they kind of batshit crazy, or am I just assuming that?
Well, I mean, I think that depends on what you mean by batshit crazy, but yes, they both kind of come in that post Crouching Tiger.
Okay, period. Right, where everything was real stylized and
correct,
kind of beautiful at the same time.
Right,
I guess those aren't necessarily two different thoughts, but I think there's touches of that in this movie. I think that they're the scenes of the soldiers, you know, going to their placements on the wall where everybody's color coded, like the archers are all in kind of red, fantastic, you know, armor that wouldn't have ever been practical ever. And the crazy archer, not archer, but like bungee jumping women who jump off the wall and stab the monster dogs with spears. I think it's an interesting concept. I never thought it felt like it embraced its kind of alternate history weirdness enough, and it was just boring to me.
But I would agree with that. I feel like one thing I want from a movie above all else, especially a weird movie like this, is fucking commitment.
yes.
And like, if you're making a movie about giant hordes of monsters trying to fuck up the Great Wall of China, then make that movie, and don't try to make it into something else necessarily. And I think that they missed a lot of grand opportunities for, you know, just bizarre, like absurd stylized martial arts. Like you mentioned the ladies with the spears. Like, I love that in theory.
Yeah.
And it looked kind of cool, but like, it didn't look cool enough.
Yeah. There's a lot of ideas that are cool in potentia here, but they just never quite cross that bridge. And I feel like a lot of it has to do with Matt Damon. Kind of look, he's not good in this movie. He has a very fake Irish accent, I guess he's supposed to be.
Or Scottish? I couldn't figure out what the hell was that.
I don't know what it was supposed to be either. But you know, there was a lot of concern initially when this movie was announced that this was going to be some whitewashing of Asian culture. And it's not. This is a very, very Chinese movie. Most of the dialogue is in Mandarin, and most of it's subtitled. So I just don't really understand, like, Matt Damon's character has no real arc. He just sort of shows up and goes, okay, I'm going to fight these horrible demon dogs that I knew nothing about, you know, 2 days ago, and now it's changed my entire worldview. And he just acts like he's fine. And that's one of those things I can't stand in movies that don't really acknowledge the fact that some of these characters have had their worldviews just completely upended. And they're totally fine with it. I wish more movies would embrace the weirdness. You know, maybe I don't want them to go all the way and have Matt Damon be, you know, reduced to some state of PTSD where he can't function. But you know, at least acknowledge that fighting fucking demon dogs is weird. But this movie never really does. Oh, how about the? What did you think about the sort of Deus Ex Machina that stops the dogs? I'm gonna call them dogs, but what are they? Aliens?
Demons, yeah, demon dogs. I
they're
think
like,
works.
Well, they came from a meteor, so they're aliens at some point. I don't think they're demons, but the fact that it's a magnet that makes them go to sleep or deaf or whatever it is.
Well, they have that extra sensory where their queen sort of communicates with them via telepathy.
Yeah.
And the magnet blocks that. I mean, what the fuck ever. You need something. It's a monster movie. Something kills the monster. Why the fuck not a magnet? What else are they going to use?
I remember, and Cody, I don't know if you're listening all the way right now, because sometimes he goes to sleep when we talk about shit he doesn't see.
I go memes.
Goes memes. Do you remember, and I brought this up to my girlfriend after seeing the movie, do you remember when you and I were sitting side by side at The Boy Next Door? The Jennifer Lopez movie.
Are you talking about the hanging thing from the ceiling?
The hanging thing from the ceiling. And James, have you seen The Boy Next Door?
I have not.
Okay, so the premise of the movie is Jennifer Lopez fucks the kid next door, who's 18, sure. So it's cool. But he's still a student at the high school that she teaches at. Anyway, and, you know, shit goes bad. He's going to get psycho on her. And there's a scene, the scene at the beginning, the film opens with, for whatever reason, they're walking around, like her character and someone else. Who was the actress in that? I feel like it was someone like.
Was it Jamie Presley or something?
Oh, God. I don't think it was Jamie Presley, but that would have been awesome if it was Jamie Presley.
I'll look it up.
Anyway, she's walking around with a character at like a farmhouse. And I think it's one of those people that. Oh, it's Kristen Chenoweth.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I was close.
You were close. Kind of a bony, skinny blonde girl, woman. And you know, like, you know two things going into that scene. But you know that that's where the finale is going to happen, and that Kristen Chenoweth is going to die. But I remember they showed there was a shot of them walking through the barn or whatever it was, and there's an engine block hanging from a chain. And I literally leaned over to Cody and I go, that's how he's going to die.
Yeah, it was Chekhov's engine hanging yes. from the ceiling.
So the Great Wall has Chekhov's magnet in the first few minutes where these like dirty mercenaries are trying to lighten their load. And one of them goes like, oh, I guess we don't need this magnet. And then Matt Damon goes, oh, I'll take it. I can make a compass out of it. Like, why the fuck does he have a giant magnet rock anyway? Like, what's happening?
But, yeah, that was so ridiculous, and it was so obvious. It's like, oh, well, they're going to need that. Yeah, they might as well just said, like, we're going to need this. And I wonder how much – go ahead.
No, go. You're fine. Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering how much, like – and I know it had the American scripts, but I really wonder how much the Chinese studios and producers kind of interfered with that, and, like, how much of that – the problems with the story came from compromises made between – the two studios and even systems of filmmaking.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about that who he's a big fan of Asian cinema, and his husband is Chinese. But he was talking about how some of these things that are like kind of really, really well-worn tropes for the United States, you know, for American filmgoers, are really sort of new or approach differently in China. So maybe something that you find like, man, that's really fucking weird or obvious is that could be chalked up to the difference in the market and the difference in the filmmaking process. So I'd like to think that's it. And it's not just some lazy piece of shit. But it like as an American viewer, it feels like, okay, yeah, they're going to need a magnet. So let's just write in that they have a magnet. Why not? But you know, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt when it comes to that being some sort of cultural storytelling difference. Anyway, enough of this movie. What grade would you give The Great Wall, James?
I'd say C minus.
I gave it a C. I didn't hate it as much as I thought I was going to. And I think you and I talked about that on Facebook going in, how much it didn't live up to the hatred we were expecting.
You know, it could have been a lot worse. I think that there were moments where, like, something sort of like poignancy started to peek through. And, like, you could almost see the movie that they wanted to make. And that might have been a good movie. It just didn't happen.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and move on to our last movie, A Cure for Wellness.
Hey, was machen Sie hier? Sorry, I don't understand.
Was machen Sie hier? Sie haben ja nichts zu suchen.
Take it easy.
Wacht! It's all right. Mr. Lockhart, every time I turn around, you're somewhere you're not supposed to be.
I guess I'm lost. I'm just trying to find my way back to my room.
This is a restricted floor. There are signs everywhere. Surely you didn't just wander down here by accident. What is it exactly that you are looking for?
I had a problem with my tooth.
The tooth?
Actually, it's feeling much better if you could just point me in the direction of my room.
Nonsense. We can't let you get an infection. You must let us take care of you. After all, that's why you're here.
An ambitious young executive is sent to retrieve his company's CEO from an idyllic but mysterious wellness center at a remote location in the Swiss Alps, but soon suspects that the spa's treatments are not what they seem. So I didn't see this, but the two of you did. Cody, what do you think of A Cure for Wellness?
Oh, man. So we saw this 2 weeks ago?
That's about right, yeah.
I know what you're thinking. The great director of The Lone Ranger, the awesome actor Dane DeHaan, who's – I really don't like him in anything. But anyway, it is a film that's been heavily marketed lately for being kind of weird and creepy and different. And
famously recently – I don't know, did you hear this?
Yeah.
The fake news. They wrote fake news stories – on fake websites, and it was a viral marketing thing, and they got their asses handed to them by the public at large, who's still reeling from, you know, the real fake news thing.
Yeah, and something that it's getting compared to a lot is Shutter Island. And Shutter Island is a movie that I really like. I know that a lot of people, it's not everyone's favorite Scorsese movie, but I really like Shutter Island. But I think that the two are similar in certain ways, but I don't think that that's necessarily a completely apt comparison. But what it is it's kind of a take on this person is at a mysterious place where he's the only one who knows what's truly going on, and he has to convince everyone else, but they're going along with it. So he thinks he's crazy, and then the audience is like, is he crazy? Is everyone else crazy? And essentially that is the way that you can boil down this movie. Like, it really is as simple as that. And so imagine that kind of plot executed in the worst way imaginable, and you have some sort of sense of what A Cure for Wellness is like. One thing that I will say good about it, it's got some pretty nice visuals. It's visually striking. It looks cool. And then that's about where the compliments stop, because, you know, what you have is a movie that is it takes its premise and it trickles out details little by little by little, and they're useless details that provide almost nothing. And as you're getting little by little, you just find yourself not caring on any level. And so they trickle out these useless details to push the narrative forward, and then the last half hour is just batshit crazy insane, and not in the good way. You know, they basically just vomit out the last 30 minutes after slowly trickling useless details throughout. And it's just boring. It's just a boring movie. And every minute that happens is more boring and uninteresting than the one that came before it. And it just gets progressively worse and harder to watch. And I have nothing good to say about it, really.
James, do you feel as badly about this movie as Cody does?
You know, I don't. And this happens a lot with me and Cody. Like, we kind of like reach different from conclusions with like the same premise. And like,
are you saying that Cody's wrong? You can say he's wrong. It's fine.
No, because I think that on a purely objective level, I think I do have to agree with Cody. The movie is kind of insane and probably not very good. But on a subjective level, I kind of loved it. Maybe loved is a little much, but I really enjoyed it, I think, because it's a play on the old Gothic tropes, and for me personally, you put a fucking old castle on a hill in a European town and I'm halfway there already. And that's what this movie is. Now, Cody's right. It is slow. It's almost painfully slow. At 2.5 hours, I think it probably way overstayed its welcome.
By at least an hour.
I'd say at a tight 2 hours, it might have been a lot better. But like, it's weird because I see everywhere Cody's coming from, but I don't think that I agree because he's right. It is batshit. And the thing about it is Gore Verbinski is fucking batshit. That's like his entire career is defined by batshittery. I mean, like his first movie was fucking Mouse Hunt. And like for like a benign kids movie, that movie is fucking crazy.
I remember having to watch Mouse Hunt in passing on a loop when it came out on video, because I worked at a grocery store in the video department. We just played whatever inoffensive kids movie was newest. And I remember watching like Mouse Hunt, going through that with it's Nathan Lane and who's the other guy? There's a mouse, but there's the guy that was in There's Something About Mary.
Lee Pace
or something like that.
Yeah.
Harvey Oswald?
Harvey Oswald.
Shut the fuck up, Cody. It was let's see, who is it? Lee Evans, sorry. Lee Pace is what the fuck else has Lee Evans been in? Apparently not much since then.
I hope you don't peek at Mouse Hunt.
I think he peaked at There's Something About Mary because it came out the year afterward. So, anyway. Mouse Hunt. Where were we at with this?
My point was is that Gore Verbinski, like his entire career is like batshit. He's always been sort of a low-rent Tim Burton. And I feel like he's really embraced that. And just like at this point just makes movies for an audience of one, and that's Gore Verbinski. And he doesn't really give a shit who his audience is or if there even is an audience. And he kind of rolls with that. And there's something about that I almost respect and appreciate, because the result is shit that's like so insane that I kind of lost my thread there.
Obviously, his biggest film is the first Pirates of the Caribbean, which I don't know about either of you, but I still love that movie. And I think you know, it probably has one of the more intriguing entrances for a character in the last 20 years, when Jack Sparrow rides in and he's on the sinking ship and he's on the, you know, like in the crow's nest, and it ends up like just floating right above the water and he steps off onto the pier. I think
that was great. And yeah, that kind of actually goes to my point, because like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean is what, like a 10-minute ride at Disney, and he turned it into, you know, a movie that was so successful that we're expecting the fifth movie soon.
Yeah. And like, and he made the second two weird as fuck, as you mentioned.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there's those like giant crabs that are moving the ship around the afterlife. Like, it's fucking, they're get fucking weird.
Let me ask you a question, James. Did you figure out what was going to happen in this movie super early on?
Well, yeah, but I've also read and seen a lot of the old gothic dramas. So like, it really follows that like beat by beat. There's nothing surprising about the movie. Well,
but that's the inherent problem with the movie, in my opinion, is that the end and how this movie's going to end, or what the twist is, or what's going on, is obvious from the get-go, but yet it slowly trickles out its details and it takes fucking forever to get there, even though you know what it's going to be on some level. And then when it finally gets there, the last 30 minutes are just nuts. But and again, I say that not in a good way. But I think my main problem with it is just the way that it treats the audience, in that it's giving you something that isn't surprising. It's easily predictable. You've got it in the first 10 minutes, and it takes forever for them to finally reveal, oh yeah, you were right.
I see what you're saying, and again, I don't disagree. Like, I fully admit that I'm probably the wrong one here, and I'm not trying to argue necessarily that this is a great movie, but like, I had a lot of fun with it. And I almost feel like this sounds like such a cop out, but like everything you just said, it's like, well, yeah, that's the point, because it just sounded like he just wanted to make a crazy gothic horror drama about fucking eels.
Yeah. I mean,
there's eels in this. You didn't tell me there were eels, Cody.
Well, I know that you like a good slippery eel every so often, so.
Dad, let him slip through my fingers. I don't know what that means. Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap this up. What are your grades? Cody?
I'm giving it the D.
Ooh. Cody doesn't give out the D easily, but if you ask nicely.
That's not what I heard.
You are right. You are right about that. James, what's your grade?
I'm going to go with C- on this one as well.
All right, that's going to do it for reviews. Let's move on to our next segment.
Find a comfy spot on the couch, and welcome to No Ticket Required.
Yes, this is No Ticket Required, our home video segment. That's such a weird term to use. Is there another way to describe that?
I call them home releases.
Okay.
I think that's the standard.
Home releases?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds very, like non-committal. Home releases
doesn't
of
it?
What? Of bodily fluids? of kidnapping victims? What? Anyway, this is our typically Netflix, On Demand, Amazon, Hulu, and DVD and Blu-ray. And you've got a home video release this week, Cody. I'm going to call it home video, so fuck both of you. I don't care what you say about home releases. A movie coming out this week for viewing at home. My best film, my favorite film of last year, the number one on my top 10 list last year, Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah. And the number two on my list was Manchester by the Sea. This is a movie. So lost in the doldrums of December when we didn't do shows for a lot of the time, we didn't get to talk about this movie. Which is a shame because it's incredible. And, it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray on Tuesday. And I think that it's one of those films where it's really going to test your ability to handle heavy themes, because it's another one of those movies that is super heavy, and the moment that the thing that sets everything in motion is super depressing and sad, and yet somehow the movie retains some humor. And so this is Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams, and then also Lucas Hedges, which is a younger actor who I think is the thing that holds the glue that holds the whole movie together. He was nominated for an Oscar, but I think that as great as Casey Affleck is, and he probably gives the best performance of the year, Lucas Hedges stands toe to toe with him. And for those who don't know, it's about a guy who serves as a janitor and. In Massachusetts, and essentially what happens is his brother dies, and his brother leaves.
Brother played what? By his brother played by
Coach Eric Taylor.
Coach Eric Taylor, you're making me forget his fucking name by saying that.
Kyle Chandler.
Kyle Chandler. God damn it! You know what? What's a weird thing that bugged me about this movie, and this is a stupid thing, but both Affleck and Kyle Chandler's characters. Share the last name Chandler.
Yeah.
But Kyle Chandler it has a different name. And
yeah.
That bothers me for some reason, and I don't know why. It's a weird kind of OCD thing. I'd be like, why don't you just change their names instead of having an actor, like a famous actor, play another Chandler? Or just name him Kyle Chandler for no reason.
that would be actually pretty funny. But yeah,
totally out of place in this movie.
So back to the fact that his brother dies. And, while we're keeping it lighthearted, so the brother dies and gives custody to, Casey Affleck's character as his guardian.
Who is woefully unprepared and unwanting of this.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's some great things that Casey Affleck does in this movie. I think that, his acting, and he does this thing while he's acting where he's kind of like always looking off into the distance, and he's just has like vacant eyes where you can see that he's just in pain through most of the film.
The premise, I mean, the reason he doesn't want this, he's broken by something, and we won't tell you what, but there's something that happened to him that's kind of revealed in little bits and pieces along the way that have left him just a shell of a man, and he's having to deal with his brother's death and taking care of this teenage boy. I don't know what his nephew. There you go. And he doesn't want it, but there's humor in those moments too. Like one of the like kind of darkest, funniest things I think in the film is they get upset. The Lucas Hedges character gets upset because they can't bury his dad because it's too cold and the ground is frozen.
Yeah.
So they have to stick him in a freezer, essentially. And it's kind of this dark comic, like, back and forth about it. And then,
yes,
then they lose the car. Like, they can't find where they parked.
Yeah.
So it's just this, like, bizarre little moment of humor. You know, it's not laugh out loud funny, but it does feel like real frustrations that people would feel in this moment. Like, just kind of like, can you believe this shit sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's a testament to how well written the script is, where, you know, you just get a sense that this is a story that, like you said, when we find out why Casey Affleck is as broken as he is, it happens about, what, 30 minutes into the movie, maybe? And it happens in small pieces. And the reveal is devastating.
I think it's closer to an hour in or so, but it's not.
Is it that far in?
Because there's flashbacks in the film that kind of set the stage, and then there's the big reveal. I want to say about an hour in. I don't remember. It's been a couple months since I've seen it, but
yeah. And then like I said, you know, Hedges is basically channeling a young Matt Damon throughout the whole thing, and it's just a really good, solid story that's admittedly pretty basic, but done, you know, expertly well, with great acting, with great performances. And then, you know, on the Blu-ray, there's some good stuff. Like there's a segment where you get some of the actors and creators talking about the movie. And then there's some deleted scenes, and one of them has to do with something that was cut out, which was a funeral scene. And it's kind of funny to see, like, because in a movie that is super bleak, it's weird, because this scene actually takes it to a different level, and it's easy to see why they would have cut it out. And I think I kind of want to tell you about it when we're off this, because to me it like, that small 2-minute scene may have changed a lot about the movie, in how we saw it, or we saw the characters. So overall, it's absolutely worth seeking out and watching. You know, it's depressing, but it's really, really great.
I love how the dissemination of media has made things come out so much faster now.
When I started
really getting into film in the late 90s, it'd be like 6 months before it came out on VHS. And James, do you remember this? Did you buy movies back then?
I do. I remember, like, you started saying that, and I remembered, like, this is probably going to date me, but I really, really loved Stargate when it came out in the theaters.
Uh-huh.
And I remember waiting to buy that, and it taking so fucking long, and I was just getting angrier and angrier.
There used to be a thing where they would only sell it for rental. Well, you could buy it, but like, each copy costs like $89 or something.
Yeah, I remember. I actually had a little brat friend who made his mom buy the $100 copy of Terminator 2 when that happened.
I remember going to Suncoast Motion Picture Company, as it was called, and seeing like Star Trek 6 there, and that was the last one I didn't have, and I didn't see it in theaters. Because I had the box set of like 1 through 5, that actually, like, the spines made a picture of the Enterprise, but it was like $89, so I had to wait. I think I ended up buying it used from Blockbuster, like 2 months later. But back to Manchester by the Sea, just a really great movie, one of the saddest movies you'll probably ever see. But I don't think it's depressing sad. I think it's. It ends a little uplifting, I think, but it doesn't compromise what came before it. So that's coming out.
It's not manipulative either, I don't
think.
When you say sad, like, where does it rank next to, say, Dancer in the Dark?
I haven't seen Dancer in the Dark, so.
Really?
100%.
It's a uplifting, life affirming. No, it's not.
That's Bjork, but, right?
Yeah, with in a movie by Lars von Trier.
Oh, fuck. Okay. Then, yeah. Well, Lars von Trier, I think everything Lars von Trier makes is sadder than this. I think the last Lars von Trier I saw was Melancholia. which was a tough slog for me personally.
Yeah.
The last one I saw was Nymphomaniac 1, and I was like, I'm not going to watch 2, I don't think.
This comes out on Tuesday, February 21st. Is that correct? And I got the
date. Yeah, get it at a Blockbuster near you.
You can get it on Amazon. This is an Amazon film.
Yes, it
so
is.
So I assume a certain amount of time, it'll be on Amazon Prime.
I would think so, yeah. And but you can – I mean, I don't know, because now there's those studio restrictions on Redbox. Just buy it.
Buy it. I've had it – not for – apropos of nothing, well, other than it's Amazon. I had to call Amazon customer service today for Prime because I'm trying to watch The Americans season 3 I'm on now finally. And for some reason, the subtitles of the translated Russian aren't showing up. And that's like a good third of the show. So like all the Russian conversations are just if you don't know Russian, you're fucked. But they should have a subtitle.
Maybe it's like that scene in the restaurant in Godfather where you're not supposed to read it, but you're supposed to.
You're not supposed to know. I don't think so, because otherwise I'm like, well, what the fuck are they talking about? Like, it's like 5-minute scenes that have no context. But Amazon said it's a bug that they're aware of, so.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, that's going to do it for this week. If you want to reach us, you can email us at podcast@cinesnob.net. You can call us at 920-FILM-210. That's 920-345-6210. You can find us on Twitter at Cinesnob, Facebook, Cinesnob Critic. James, what's your stuff? You want to pimp yourself?
Yeah, I'm good.
Oh.
You can read my reviews at glidemagazine.com.
Are you an active tweeter?
My bio on Twitter actually says it all. Terrible at Twitter.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it's at J Roberts 3456 if anyone wants to deal with me being awful at Twitter.
You know, I don't tweet as much as I should as someone who wants to be visually, like out there and put my stuff out there. It's just so hard. Like I have to do it.
I angry tweet about politics more than anything these days.
I have to do it for work. Like I handle our work accounts, and it's just like, if I'm like, it's been 20 minutes since I've tweeted, I've disappeared off the face of the earth as far as Twitter is concerned. So.
Yeah. And I'm not good at it. So I read Twitter all the time, but I never feel like I have anything great to say. So I just kind of back out.
I saw you tweet something the other day, and I was like, who the fuck is this? And I realized it was you. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, was it Cody's, like, emo handle, or was it his CineSnob handle?
I believe it was his CineSnob handle.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, look, I have two accounts. One is a personal thing where I talk about sports mostly, and then the other is my movie account.
What is the fuck? I don't get your name on that personal one. I don't understand it. Is it some –
It's an inside joke. It's an inside reference it's a band reference, basically.
Well, I could have guaranteed you it was a fucking band reference. I just wanted to know what it meant.
What's the reference?
Well, so there was a band that I liked called World Under Blood, but it's a retarded, like, it's a stupid name. And so
nice catch, by the way.
it's a monumentally stupid name. So I just put. I kept on saying, like, I found it funny to say everything under blood, like pizza under blood or whatever, and then it morphed into Cody under blood.
Oh.
And it's actually been funny because one time, oh man, this story is not going to be good. But so one time,
what's new? Why start now?
Well, because I'm already into it. So, you mean why start? Okay, yeah, good one.
Oh,
so anyway,
fuck, man, I just like dug up a goddamn fucking Rudy Giuliani reference joke, and you didn't even get.
Oh, a 9/11 Rudy Giuliani joke. Wow,
that was an SNL post 9/11 Rudy Giuliani joke.
Yeah, good one. So, so anyway, what happened was basically I won a contest where they read my screen name, my Twitter handle on TV on Fox Sports, and they said
what kind of contest?
It was a trivia contest that I won,
but
and
the
so they
the
said
prize was, the prize was
it was like an autographed hockey puck that I won.
Okay.
And so
autographed by whom?
Oh, just some shitty minor leaguer that never did anything. No. But the guy is announcing it, and he goes, "And tonight's winner is Cody Underblood." And I was like, like he pronounced it like it was all together, like my last name. And it was like, this is stupid.
It sounds like you're like some old vampire, you're the son of an old vampire. Like, that was Dracul Underblood and his son Cody. I had a Twitter joke of mine read on the old Web Soup show once. You remember Web Soup?
Web Soup?
Web Soup was it launched essentially the same time as Tosh.0 did. And you remember the Soup franchise that was on E?
Yeah. Who hosted Web Soup? Was that Hardwick?
Of course it was fucking Chris Hardwick. It was Hardwick before he was like a mega star again, or I guess ever. It was like before he was hosting everything.
Yeah,
and it was like the thing was they would tweet out a clip and you would have to tweet a joke, and if they liked your joke, they'd read it on the air.
It's weird to me to think that there is a time that Twitter was prominent like that on TV where Chris Hardwick wasn't on the forefront of that.
Well, this was like 2009, I want to say. 2010? So it's been a while ago.
I feel like Twitter has only been utilized in like TV like that or something in the past like 5 years.
Oh, it's a fucking cesspool of shit. I mean, it used to be fun, but now it's a cesspool of awfulness. But, you know, one time I wrote a joke about some guy getting hit in the nuts with a potato gun. And it was read on
and it was your finest moment on Twitter.
Because you know how there's web clips of guys just hitting themselves in the nuts, right?
Yeah, America's Funniest Home Videos made a living on that.
Well, but like guys purposely hitting themselves in the nuts.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's a whole different world, Cody. But this guy had a – you know what a potato gun is, right?
Yeah, it's a gun that shoots potatoes.
Well, right. So it's like shoots them at a high velocity. And someone point it right at his balls, and they shot a potato at him.
Did you make a tater tots joke?
I did. My joke was that tater gun has ensured he'll never have tots. Hey, you know what? Imagine those words coming out of Chris Hardwick's mouth, and you'll see how perfect that joke was for him to read.
Look, if you're going to rag on Kiko for his dad jokes, then you have no ground to stand on.
I'm telling you, I wrote the joke for fucking Chris Hardwick to say.
Yeah, that's why you wrote it. You didn't write it because you thought it was gold.
I didn't think it was. Look, man, you got to write to your audience. And I know that the Chris Hardwick found that fucking hilarious.
That maybe that says more about him than anything else.
Anyway, so that's going to do it for this week. Wait, are we done? Anything else to add, Cody? All right. Thanks again, James, for joining us. This was fun.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I like having a third voice to bounce off of. Oh, well, we'll see about that. But
I wouldn't blame you for not having me back.
We like having it's nice to have a third voice in here instead of just me talking to Cody when he goes to, like, eat an egg or something.
I do that quite frequently. Or, like, I'm just like, you know what, I feel like Jared's going to talk for a while, so I'm going to go make dinner.
Or, like, ice cream will arrive or something.
Yeah, I've had Amazon Prime orders show up in the middle of the show.
Anyway, that's it. On that note, I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
And I'm James Roberts.
Thank you for listening to the Cine Snob podcast. To read reviews, interviews, and more, visit cinesnob.net. See you next week.